The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, the Champions League. And just when we thought PSG had blown it, they showed that never say die attitude that we have come to know and love. And if I had a pound for every time I thought about tweeting about Eric Choupo-Moting not being able to do it on a cold Tuesday night in Stoke, but managing it in the Champions League quarterfinals, I'd have a pound. We'll look ahead to the other quarterfinals, Leipzig v Atleti, Man City Leon, and Bayern versus Messi. In the Europa League, late heartbreak for Wolves. Ole wins the Norse battle against Solbakken, while Inter and Shakhtar make it through. We'll chat Charlton and Macclesfield with Ben Fisher, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendening, it's nice to see you.
Always a pleasure, Max.
Hello, Lars Sivertsen. Now, Lars, you've gone comedy Zoom and put a fjord behind you, haven't you?
That's not comedy. That's, you know, got to bring some lovely Norwegian nature to your lives on this fine morning.
Hello, Jordan Jarrett-Bryan. Nice to see you.
Good morning, mate. How are you?
I'm good. And the reason Lars did it is because you can't take off the Golden Gate Bridge behind you, which I presume you have for your comedy friend Zoom chats on the weekends.
It was pure accidental, but I'm keeping it because it looks good-ish.
Now, Atalanta 1, Paris Saint-Germain 2. Atalanta just, 4 minutes away from their first Champions League semi-final, and then that. 149 seconds between Marquinhos scoring PSG's equaliser, Eric-Maxim Choupo-Moting scoring the winner, had the slight air of United v Bayern in 99. Ryan says, has there been a more upsetting outcome for neutrals since Suarez handball v Ghana? Jimmy says, after the PSG comeback, who is more upset, Atalanta or Barry? And Rod says, how gutted is Barry about the PSG result? Disclaimer, I was so looking forward to the tweet he ended up saving to drafts.
Yeah, I'm pretty gutted, I have to say. I had my finger poised over the send button on a tweet that had several crying laughing emojis with PSG, the Champions League gift that keeps on giving. But I have saved it to drafts. But, you know, hopefully they will blow it further along the line.
I had a similar tweet ready to go for just after the Brexit referendum, and I have not been able to use that one. Did they deserve to win, Lars?
Yeah, they did. Listen, there's two sides to this, which is, on the one hand, like, Atalanta this season in particular is sort of everything you dream of as a football fan if you don't support one of the sort of 10, 12 wealthiest European clubs. You know, they're a small town club who their budget is roughly the same as like Derby County or Nottingham Forest thereabouts in terms of their wage bill. They're a club who's a big part of their local community. Famously, they send out like little shirts to newborn babies in the area. And obviously they've gone through an atrocious time with COVID, and the club is really banal as it might sound, giving them some joy when they've come back and played really well, and that they've been able to, in spite of their relative size and the fact they're not a big club and never going to be a big club, they've been able to put together this team who can play magnificent football, who's finished third in Serie A, who were on the cusp of getting to a Champions League semi-final. But on the other hand, you have to, on the balance of performance and the chances PSG created over the 90 minutes, you have to say, in a sporting sense, on the night, it was, you know, entirely just.
Blaise says, Jordan, can the panel please not draw any conclusions from the fact that Choupo-Moting left Stoke for PSG for £0? I can certainly draw no conclusion. I don't know if you can, Jordan.
No, I really can't. But it did get me thinking about the most, I suppose, random upgrading moves of all time. And Thomas Gravesen from Everton to Real Madrid sprung to mind as well. I'm trying to think what other kind of random moves to Europe's elite have there been? I mean, yeah, since he's been there, he's been very much a bit part player. He scored actually some key goals in the cup there in France for PSG as well over the last couple of years. But he did the job. I'm a little bit with Barry on this one. I'm not a fan of PSG. I don't see them as a serious outfit. They're like this kind of guy that comes to the party that's got all the fancy gear and all the fancy clothes, and, you know, he's got the rich dad, but he can't talk to girls properly. He can't dance. He's a little bit of a wanker. Nobody likes him, but he just keeps getting invited to the kind of the top parties. You know what I mean? Because of who his dad is. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of them. I actually think PSG, in some ways, weren't the better team here. I know they created some good chances, but I felt for Atalanta. I really enjoyed watching Gasperini's team this year. And I think that they'll be disappointed that they didn't get the job done in the end. I think if they'd have lost 2-1 in those circumstances to a Bayern Munich or a Real Madrid or a Man City, they'd kind of take that. But I think looking back now, you think, we lost to a team, okay, with a few superstars in it, but that's not a very good PSG team for me, and it never really has been.
On the subject of, you know, great upgrades, producer Sammy says, Woodgate to Real Madrid. He's sort of had the potential, Woodgate, didn't he?
Yeah, he's been very good, Yeah. Julian Faubert to Real Madrid might be a better entry into this category. That was an odd one.
Yeah, well, Liam says, you know, should Stoke be now expecting a bid from PSG for Sam Vokes or Lee Gregory?
Could we put Andy Robertson from Hull to Liverpool in that bracket?
I don't know if we could. I think there's a difference between like a young player.
Yeah.
I don't know how old Choupo-Moting is. I mean, you can, Barry. I suspect we all have slightly different, you know.
Define your own rules.
Yeah, define your own container for weird random upgrades. Did you think Neymar was good? I saw Barney tweeting, you know, Neymar dismissed as a gadfly, bottler, choker, etc. by BT pundits who don't seem to realise he was injured the last 2 years at this stage. Looks of bafflement in the studio when Neymar doesn't give up and instead helps win the game at the end.
Well, I suppose that is the reputation he has, whether he deserves it or not. I was impressed with his performance. He drove the team forward. He created good chances, a couple of inexplicable misses that you would expect him to score in his sleep. And he kept going till the death. And, you know, that's the least you should expect from a professional footballer. But I suppose it's not what we tend to expect from Neymar. I was impressed with his performance.
I do wonder if there's a danger with him because he comes across sometimes as a bit of a nitwit, and there's a lot with him that's a bit annoying that we then fail to appreciate it when he is very, very good on the pitch, which is quite often. And I think that's the whole reaction to this game was sort of conflated by this. I mean, there's very little sympathy or enthusiasm for PSG out there among neutrals. I think friend of the show, Elliot Ross, who made the point that is PSG the least cool team in sort of sporting history, which I think is a fair shout. And I think there's a lot of that. But if you try to, you know, if you try to sort of ignore what the team is and what the club represents in the sort of grand scheme of modern football, you have to appreciate that what Neymar does on the pitch, he's very good. Except, I was saying, philosophically, if a forward is doing a bunch of things and creating stuff but not finishing, is he then playing well? I mean, there's a philosophical discussion to be had there.
Can we just go back to that miss that Barry referenced there? I think that's one of the worst misses I've ever seen at top level football. Especially considering the player that missed it, that's a shocking miss. And the reason why I can't fathom, or I feel it was such a bad miss, is because I don't even know what he was trying to do. I saw the replays. I'm thinking, how do you put it that wide? It's such a bad miss.
Are you this spiky, Jordan? Because it's 8 o'clock in the morning, not 9.
It's just PSG. I just don't like PSG.
Do you know what? On the Ronnie Rosenthal scale of misses, right? For which I put Ronnie Rosenthal at, you know, the absolute peak. I think the one thing, and okay, yes, it is Neymar, that it's a fantastic footballer doing it. If you are running at pace, that is the one thing that sort of you can sort of forgive someone a bit more than if you're
No. It's not even like he's kissed the outside of the post. He's put it so wide. So wide. I don't understand how he's missed it that badly. But maybe I'm just cranky in the morning. That could just be me.
It's interesting, though, with PSG, isn't it? Because when they get it right, because of the pace of some of the players, and Mbappe came on, he's obviously so quick, and Neymar's so quick, there are some moves. I think Neymar and Herrera played this sort of 1-2, and Neymar got in, and you just thought, God, when they get it right, it's pretty scintillating.
Yeah, I guess, yes. And if we have to have these teams, if this is what modern football is becoming, at least they can be entertaining. And to be fair to PSG, I think they have been a less nonsensical team in general this season. I think it was our dear friend Jonathan Wilson who wrote a very angry piece on how they were more this sort of bizarro construct than an actual football team. I think it was last season. And they have often looked like that. But under Tuchel, they've rounded out the squad a little bit in sort of sensible manner. For this game, ironically, having been a team that had no water carriers for a while, there were too many of them in midfield. Field now, and they really missed Verratti in terms of linking up. I mean, I think it was 2018 they played away. They played to Real Madrid, and they had sort of Rabiot playing box to box, and they had Verratti spraying passes around, and like Lo Celso was the holding midfielder. Like they were in dire need of someone to just do the donkey work. And now today there were three worker bees in midfield there, very good worker bees and very expensive worker bees, but they lacked someone to connect the attack with the defense. And I think that's they were more sort of they don't do. This season, it hasn't been this much pass it to Neymar, whatever happens. Like, they've been a more rounded team in general. Like, when they beat Real Madrid in the autumn, when they came back against Dortmund. I think circumstance with Verratti being out, with Di Maria being out, with Mbappe starting on the bench, I mean, that is why it was as disjointed as it was for a while. And when Mbappe came on, you see, he is extraordinary. Like, he's truly magnificent. And having him and Neymar running at you is very bad for any defence.
And just that pain, Barry, for Atalanta, for it to sort of do everything pretty much right for just almost all the football match. And then by the end, they only had 10 guys and they had one bloke sort of bandaged up like a sort of, you know, he'd been to war, just hobbling about up front. And you could just it was like a deck of cards, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a devastating blow for them. And they're obviously dead on their feet. And when you're like that, to see Kylian Mbappe coming on must be just soul-destroying. They have overperformed. They've punched above their weight. They've every reason to be incredibly proud of themselves. And I suppose they have the consolation that they have qualified for next season's Champions League. They've made a lot of friends this season. And the disappointment will pass. They haven't, you know, embarrass themselves, right? And there's no shame in losing that game last night. It's just the circumstances in which they lost must be particularly devastating.
We saw last season sort of Ajax get carved up after doing well in the Champions League. Lars, do you think are there players that will go, or do you think it's a slightly different situation?
There's a risk of that, but you know, like someone like Papu Gomez is like 32 or something, so it's not quite... But there will be interest, yeah, for sure. But what we've seen with Atalanta is that they've been signing very well for the last couple of years, even if they do end up cashing in on one or two of the players. I mean, bearing in mind, this is kind of like the second team Gasperini has had at Atalanta. The first time they punched above their weight and surprised everyone, it was much more sort of fueled by homegrown players, many of whom they ended up selling for quite big fees. And then they reinvested that money and built the team they have now. So they've shown that it's not just a sort of fluke of 11 players who've come together and are certainly mysteriously good. This is a club who've been very cleverly run and very well coached over a couple of years now. So I'd be surprised if they collapsed, if they were, you know, picked apart and collapsed. And looking to the future for them, Juventus next season will have a manager who's literally never managed the game in his life at any level. So perhaps they'll be slightly more vulnerable than usual. And, you know, fingers crossed, it would be amazing to see them have a proper title tilt next season, if such a thing is possible.
Connor says, if PSG win the Champions League, it's only fair Barry has to face an eating challenge. How many baguettes can he eat in 30 minutes, perhaps? Barry, are you interested?
Well, it isn't fair that I should have to face an eating challenge. I have been proved right about PSG. When they went out last season, that was total vindication for me. So they could win every Champions League for the rest of history, or the rest of time, and I will still have been right. So, no, I don't have to face an eating challenge.
All right, fine. Let's look ahead to the other quarterfinals then. Man City, Lyon's on Saturday night. City struggled a bit against Lyon in the group stages. I mean, I must admit, I can't remember the group stages. It was so long ago, I couldn't even remember who they played. Jordan, I mean, City, the bookies' favourites, but Pep hasn't won it since 2011. They should have too much for Lyon, right?
They should. But I'm actually really interested in this game. I don't quite get why they're the favourites. I mean, Bayern top to bottom for me looked like the most rounded team left in the competition with the most informed striker in Europe at the moment. So that puzzles me a little bit, but I guess Pep's, you know, pedigree in the competition kind of maybe balances that out. They should win this game. I'm not sure if Aguero will make it back for this game. I still think he'll be out, and that's a concern for me. But yeah, this would be a shock, I suppose, if Lyon were to knock them out, because Man City need to really assert themselves as a European elite. I think getting to at least the final here this year would go some way to proving that.
Barcelona play Bayern on Friday night. Barry, this is a fascinating game, actually. I mean, every part of everyone thinks Bayern have to win this game because of how good Bayern have looked, you know, certainly since, what, halfway through the season or something, and Hansi Flick's done such a brilliant job. But you can't rule out Barcelona, can you, without wanting to... You can't rule them out, Brian.
No, you can't. Of course you can't. But they are a bit of a shambles. Well, a total shambles by their own very lofty standards. But they have the little man, of course, up front, who carried them through their last game. I think he's been carrying them all season. I would be very surprised if Bayern Munich don't win this game, but I'm really looking forward to it because there is a possibility that they will lose. It will almost certainly depend on how Messi plays and if he's excellent enough to carry his team past this outstanding Bayern side. But Bayern have won, what is it, 18 matches in a row? They have to lose at some point.
Thursday night is RB Leipzig versus Atletico. Leipzig destroyed Spurs in the last 16. Atleti are Atleti. But I say that, Lars, but are, if this question makes sense, are Atleti as Atleti-y as they used to be?
They're kind of starting to become that again. Simeone said last summer that this was going to be like a bit of a transitional season for them. Some of the old guard have left and moved on, and he's kind of looking for the younger players to step up and become leaders. And as he predicted, it's been a little bit slow going in the league. I think something like the lowest points total they've had since 2011 or something. But after New Year's, sort of turn of the year, they've sort of gradually started grinding away and being a little bit more Atleti-like. I mean, they lost against Real Madrid in the derby on the 1st of February, I believe. And since then, they've played 11. They won 11, drawn 7, and lost nil in all competitions. They've not lost since then. And they're not always... repeat all the Atleti cliches you can think of. Not always great to look at, Max, but, you know, they do tend to get the job done. And we did see against Liverpool that they still have a little bit of that in them. And I think with Leipzig having lost Timo Werner, who scored 28 goals in 33 games in the Bundesliga, 35% of Leipzig's goals in the Bundesliga came from Timo Werner. They don't have him here, lacking his pace and finishing ability against a team who's not going to give up a lot of chances. That is a really big miss for them. So you would expect Atletico to sort of grind their way through this.
Not always good to look at, but get the job done, Lars. It's very rude to insult Barry when he's... on the call. He's on the call with you.
Unnecessarily mean.
I'm sorry.
You could also be talking about me there. So that's...
Do you know what? Also, the moment had passed and I thought, I just won't say this. And then I'm sorry, Barry. I didn't mean that.
It's okay. I'm just wondering about RB Leipzig. You know, in PSG and Manchester City, obviously, we have plucky underdog stories. And RB Leipzig are another one. And am I allowed like RB Leipzig? Because obviously they're this big corporate beast who've come from nowhere. But I like their policy of, you know, signing young players age 23 or under. Not, they don't have any big name fancy signings. So I'm not sure which side of the fence I should be on where RB Leipzig are concerned.
I think if these sort of petrostate clubs didn't exist, we would probably go, oh, see, Leipzig is so bad. You know, look what football has become. But just in the context of clubs being effectively owned by sort of nation states who sort of plow billions into them to for their own purposes. And again, I do recommend the last pod if you haven't listened to it yet. In that context, RB Leipzig are just kind of fine, I guess. And I completely agree, the way they do things, the way they sign players, they have a very clear philosophy of how they should play. They sign young players rather than big names. On the pitch, it's really quite likable.
I mean, eventually you get to that level where I think we've tried to do it, is find out what's the biggest team you can support with a completely clear conscience. And I think it means that Forest Green Rovers have 6 billion fans, but I'm not entirely sure. Anyway, we'll talk more about that stuff as and when. Right now, that'll do for part one. And part two, we'll do the Europa League. Part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Europa League semi-finals. Sunday night, Manchester United versus Sevilla. Monday will be Inter versus Shakhtar. Let's start with United's 1-0 win over FC Copenhagen. Lars, the Norwegian off between Solskjaer and Solbakken.
How good was that, Max?
Yeah, it went to the slightly shorter one with the hair.
Yeah.
It was a good game, actually. I thought it was a really open game. I thought it was a really exciting game. And I'd been led to believe that Copenhagen, with this sort of very rudimentary, play it safe, had no pace team. And actually, I thought they were pretty good.
It's because you didn't ask me, isn't it, Max?
Well, that is
no, they were. I have to say, in the first half, I thought FC Copenhagen were really, really impressive in the way they made it difficult for Man United. And they were quite brave in possession as well, played some really clever switches, which they kept doing. But I think in the second half, you could see they weren't able to contain United quite so much. United had a couple of shots that hit the post. I saw my compatriot, Ståle Solbakken, did say after the game that, we were equal to them in 90 minutes. I think, to be fair, United have had a fair few chances in the second half. And in the extra time, you can see they were really struggling physically, FC Copenhagen. But they were a really well put together team. And I think that kind of game was a good calling card for a few of their players. I think it was a good calling card for Ståle Solbakken as well. I think, having, you know, completely said United deserved to win on the night, it is frustrating when it's decided on a very, very soft penalty. And I think you can compare, and that's a bit of experience there for Martial, let's call it that, because, you know, he's a guy, because he's, you know, he feels a bit of a shoulder and he knows, okay, if anyone touches me in the box, I can throw myself to the ground and there's a chance I'll get a penalty. You can contrast that to the young forward for Copenhagen, Darami, who, there was a very clear shirt pull on him in the first half, that time he turned by in the box. Very blatant shirt pull. But he stays on his feet and he tries to get a finish off and is punished by the referee effectively for that. And I think it's very frustrating that that's the way these things are refereed. I don't think players should be punished for staying on their feet, but that tends to be the way it goes. But yeah, at the end of the day, probably a deserved victory for Man United, but it was slightly frustrating the way it came about.
Jordan, what did you make of the game?
Yeah, I thought it was a good game. I think the one concerning thing, if I was a United fan or look on a Solskjaer, is they seem a little bit like Wolves in their game and even the previous round against Olympiacos, to be flagging a little bit. In a way that Sevilla against Wolves didn't look like they were flagging. So going into this semi-final, if I was United, I think it's going to be a very difficult decision for Solskjaer to make as to whether he brings in some maybe inferior players who have maybe got a bit more on the legs, or sticks with the team that seems to be, well, has done very well in the second half of the season, but maybe he's running a little bit on empty. I thought, you know, Copenhagen were a little bit unlucky. They had a couple of chances to really punish United and were unable to do that for various reasons. The front three, I think, for United looked good, but again, a little bit leggy. But I'm quite excited to see Sevilla in this game, because I thought Sevilla did a really good job against Wolves in the previous round. So I think United have a really difficult decision about how they approach this game.
I thought Juan Mata kind of changed the game a little bit. It's always nice to see him sort of pop up occasionally. And you know, when you think you bring on Mata for Greenwood, you think, are you going to lose a lot of pace? And you know, but actually, he delayed playing passes and then played them a much more sort of decisive pass a couple of times. I think that might have partly led to the penalty. Yeah, Jordan?
No, it definitely did. But one of the things that I'm going to be looking at in particular going forward the last couple of games for United is Bruno Fernandes. Because there was a really interesting discussion on Twitter off the back of the last game about his passing, he gave the ball away a lot. But a lot of people were saying, well, that's what happens when you're a creative player, you make risky passes. But other people were saying, well, if you look at a lot of his games when he's been playing well, he's always given the ball away quite a lot. So I'm going to be player camming Bruno Fernandes in this game to see actually if he's been getting away with it a little bit in previous games, or if indeed he's just a victim of the kind of player that takes a lot of risky passes.
Well done for finding an interesting conversation on Twitter, by the way.
Well, interesting is really stretching it a little bit, but yeah.
But I can add to the mix that Bruno Fernandes was like that at Sporting as well. If you look at his numbers, his sort of pass completion numbers have always been very, very low for someone who plays in his position. And he takes an incredible amount of long shots. He seems to have calmed that down a little bit. I mean, he tends to sort of let off like 3 shots from out of the box per game, regardless of, you know, whether that's a good idea or not. And that is one of those things. The second all of these risky passes and long shots don't, you know, equate to a goal or an assist every game, they start to become incredibly frustrating. And I do think that's a debate we'll probably end up having about Fernandes at some point in the future. Can I crowbar in my Ståle Solbakken used to be dead story? Or are we kind of done by that now?
You can crowbar. I was going to come to it in a more seamless way, but that's fine.
Clunk.
Everybody, klaxon.
No, man, just
Lars wants to tell a story.
FC Copenhagen being relevant for a week in sort of mainstream sort of UK football media. I have to tell you, because he died for a bit right towards the end of his career on the training ground for FC Copenhagen. His heart stopped, and he was what they call, you know, clinically dead, which is a medical thing. His heart stopped for 7 minutes, and you know the blood was no longer pumping through his veins. But it just so happened that the club doctor was on the training ground that day, which he normally wouldn't be. And he helped sort of, they helped try to keep him alive and bring him back. And he was put to the ambulance and he got back. And it was one of those, it wasn't a heart attack. It was one of those sort of defects that some athletes have from birth. And it had never been picked up because he hadn't had a proper heart screening at any point. And it got triggered. And thankfully there were people around to bring him back. So it's an extraordinary story of him.
Actually, quite an important point on that, that, you know, that you can actually get checked for that heart defect, and it's,
yeah, you can, you
know,
but he hadn't.
You know, it's interesting. I haven't. I doubt any of you have. But actually, it's something that is probably worth doing, because if you know, then you can be prepared for. You know, we've obviously seen that in football and elsewhere in life, that you know you can be very unlucky with that. Barry, should we start giving Solskjaer more and more credit for what he's doing?
I think he has been getting credit. For you know, he got a tough time when United weren't doing well, but since the arrival of Bruno Fernandes, they've improved vastly. He seemed to be the missing piece of the jigsaw, and I think Solskjaer has got credit for what he's done so far. I think Solskjaer has got credit since the arrival of Fernandes. You know, it's Manchester United. It's a huge club, one of the biggest clubs in the world. Finishing fourth and not winning a trophy is acceptable for Solskjaer in, you know, his first full season as their manager, but it's not acceptable, or it won't be acceptable in the future, you'd imagine, because of the size of the club. But he's doing better than I thought he would, and I'm, you know, happy to concede that I got that wrong. I'm still not convinced he is the right man for the job.
Can I just add to Barry's point there and say that I'm not convinced he's the right man for the job either. And this is going to sound incredibly insane, but if I was the United hierarchy, I would sack him and go and get Poch. I know that may seem very, very, very harsh, but if United are very serious about trying to return to the top table of English and thus European football, I think they have to make that ruthless decision. There is a better manager out there currently. Go and get him. So he's done a great job in getting them to where he has right now, Solskjaer. And I think I was one of the harshest people on Solskjaer when they were bombing. I will give him credit for what he's done in the back end of the season. Fair play. I don't think he can get them any higher than that. If we're talking about mixing with Klopp and Guardiola, I think they need a better manager. There is someone out there who's better than him. I would go and get him.
Can I just check, Jordan? You've done a few shows this week at TalkSport, and you know, I work there a great deal, and I very much enjoy it. Barry enjoys it, but when you go in, they do try and give you an operation to, you know, and I just wondered if, you know, we've both, me and Barry have both resisted that. I just wonder if you've...
I did resist. This is my brain saying those crazy things for now anyway.
Barry, can we compare
to hear you say you've done a few shows on TalkSport, Max. I haven't really noticed that. I mean, are you... this is hardly ever on there.
Let's move on to the Wolves-Sevilla game that you mentioned, Jordan. Lucas Ocampos has had a 2 minutes... from time, Raul Jimenez's penalty miss was absolutely crucial, Barry, wasn't it?
Yeah, it could have changed the game completely. It was a poor penalty. And I felt for Wolves, to be honest. I honestly thought they were good enough to win this competition. Sevilla are also a very good side, but missing that penalty in the first half, and it was Traore who won it with another one of his trademark rampaging runs into the box. Who knows how the game could have turned out if that had gone in. Sevilla may still have won, but it was a blow for Wolves, obviously, to miss it. And I felt for Nuno afterwards. He looked quite forlorn in the interview, but he sort of looked on the bright side as well. No Europe for them next season. Is that perhaps an advantage after the incredibly long season they've had this time, albeit with a long break in the middle? But it could be beneficial for them to not have to play in Europe next season. Although I would imagine their fans would prefer it because they've enjoyed this crusade on foreign fields.
I think it's an interesting question as well, because I think for most managers, I think to suggest that less games would be beneficial for them. I just wonder if Nuno actually likes having lots of games. Look at the last 3 years. They've had the Championship. They've had two years now in the Premier League, but there's been just so many games, thick and fast. I wonder if he's the sort of manager that likes having lots and lots and lots of games and being able to really craft a very small number, you know, 14, 15 players to be able to play regular games, and having less games, I'm interested to see how he balances, you know, the one game a week scenario that's up and coming now.
Did anybody see the Spanish commentator of Traore when he went on that utterly amazing run? And I don't know if it's real, but it's got enough sort of retweets that I imagine it is real. He basically just starts doing a car noise as soon as Traore just he just starts going. Anyway, I don't know if it's real or not. Anyway, I'd urge you to seek it out. It's absolutely hilarious. And actually, at that moment, I just thought, "Wow, Traore is absolutely going to tear this team apart." But it didn't quite happen for him. And Sevilla, Lars, are a canny side, aren't they? And they've got some wonderful. Ava Banega's just a great, great footballer, isn't he?
You're right. I thought I didn't think they were really showed enough respect in the build-up, to be honest. This is a team that finished fourth in La Liga on the same number of points as Atletico Madrid. They've got some really, really good players, as you say. They've got tremendous experience and pedigree in this competition in particular. Julian Lopetegui has done a great job making the side gel together this season, because there were quite a few changes last summer. And no, they've done really well. They're a very good team. And I wouldn't say people said, I think there were a lot of people who thought Wolves were going to do this and almost not easily, but I thought there were not enough credit and respect was given to Sevilla ahead of the game.
Yeah, they've won the Europa League five times since 2006, which is extraordinary. Elliot Hackney on Twitter, why don't Sevilla just marry the Europa League? I enjoyed that. Achilles the Brave says, will Nuno be criticised for sitting back for a whole game, or is that just reserved for Jose Mourinho? It's quite an interesting question, that sort of how we, the lens that we view how football managers are, given how we feel about them generally. I wonder if Mourinho had managed a team that played a bit like Wolves and had, 25% possession or something, the knives would be out right now.
I thought it was the wrong approach. I was disappointed with how Wolves and Nuno set up. I thought they gave... I mean, I agree with Lars that I think the general media and the coverage was quite, you know... the lack of respect, I think, for how good they are, what they've achieved, I thought was there. But I thought the Wolves gave them too much respect during the game. And I thought they sat off them a little bit. So I was a little bit disappointed and surprised at how much Wolves allow Sevilla to dominate that particular game.
How do you see the semi-final then, Sunday night, Man United versus Sevilla?
I think United are going to have to up their game a little bit compared to their performance against FC Copenhagen. And they can't afford to miss as many chances as they did in that one. I think it's quite open. I mean, yeah, you'd make United favourite, but again, this is a Sevilla team that deserves a lot of respect. I don't know. Solskjaer seemed very content after the FC Copenhagen game with everything. But then again, I guess he does seem... He's a pretty happy guy in general, but he seemed to be not very concerned about the fitness situation. He seemed not very concerned about the performance and everything. It's an odd one that... Someone made the point on Twitter before the pod that it's odd that we're thinking, oh, you know, Wolves are out in their feet, and that's understandable because they've played so many games. I mean, there was like a 100-day break in there. It is a little bit odd that Wolves seem to have not much left in the tank compared to Sevilla, who also have played a ton of games recently.
I wonder.
And United look very tired, and I think they did look a bit tired, and they have not necessarily played that many more games than their opponents since the lockdown.
Yeah, but I wonder if it's just, it's the 13th of August. Like, footballers, just their whole clock, you know, doesn't play football at this time.
We're meant to be on a pre-season tour of Singapore at this point.
Exactly right, yeah.
What is this?
Yeah, aren't they just about to get back from Dubai or something, you know?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Oh no, hang on. Would the season just be about
to start? I was about to say, this is meant to be pretty much the first weekend of the season or something, isn't it?
Okay, yes. Yeah. So, you know, you need, as you say, you need two or three games to really get up to
I should be
fitness.
Playing out a nervy draw against Leicester City.
Exactly right, yeah.
So wrong.
I actually thought the scoreline of Manchester United Copenhagen really flattered Copenhagen. I mean, their goalkeeper, Janssen.
Yeah, he was brilliant. I'd
never heard of him before, but he had the game of his life. He was absolutely outstanding, pulled off a string of sometimes incredible saves. So I wouldn't be too concerned if I was a Manchester United fan about, you know, they did only win 1-0, but the performance was good.
Monday night, Shakhtar versus Inter. Inter got past Leverkusen 2-1. All the goals in the first 25 minutes. This was a frantic game of football, Lars.
Yes. I mean,
I thoroughly enjoyed it for lots of reasons.
Yeah, so Leverkusen manager Peter Bosch, I'm very happy that he's a thing and that he is in charge of a sort of an European club of some significance. I am also simultaneously happy that he's not in charge of a team I support, because the way he sets up his teams, like, there's so little structure there defensively. And I mean, coming up against a much more well-drilled team like Inter, I mean, there was a real gap in quality, really. But Leverkusen have some tremendous individual players, and they were never completely out of it, I guess. But I thought Inter looked really good here, and really should have been a little bit more efficient with their chances. But it was such a fun game, as Peter Boss's teams often are, because they can't defend usually. So they're great fun to watch.
As a centre forward who holds the ball up, you have to take a kicking. But Jordan Lukaku, I just don't think I've seen a centre forward get kicked that much for quite a long time.
It was quite brutal to watch. Yeah, he got absolutely battered. But, he, you know, he got his own back in the end. I thought one of the best performances I've seen from Lukaku in a very long time. In a season where I think he's had quite a lot of good performances, even with, you know, putting aside his impressive goal record this season. I've just got this kind of this dream in my head of a final between Inter and Man United. And in the 89th minute, Christian Eriksen squaring on the halfway line to Ashley Young, who bombs down the left-hand side, who crosses it for Lukaku to head at the near post to win the Europa League and beat United in the final. That would be my dream.
You've got to have Alexis Sanchez doing something.
I'm sorry,
in
of
that
course.
Goal.
He's there as well. Yes, okay. What can he do? Okay, so he steps over the ball, so dummies it for Lukaku to head at the near post and win the Europa League. That for me is my dream end to the season.
Somebody Victor Moses celebrating wildly.
Yeah. Somebody tweeted amazing to scenes. Say how Alexis Sanchez, do you remember when he was announced at Man United playing a piano? Like a ridiculous video. What they should do is do one of those celebrations where, you know, someone Ericsson's a piano stool, and then they make a piano out of all the players, and then Sanchez sits on Ericsson's back and then just tinkles the ivories for a little bit.
That seems like the kind of thing Ericsson would be into, doesn't it? He's a happy-go-lucky, fun-loving guy.
Do you hate Christian Ericsson, Lars?
I don't at all, but you know.
You clearly do.
Oh, come on. I like him. He's a lovely player.
You hate Burnley and Christian Eriksen. Right, Shakhtar 4, Basel 1. Given what you saw of the game, Barry, do you give Shakhtar... can they scare Inter a bit?
I think they could beat them. I confess I only saw extended highlights of this game, but what I saw, I was hugely impressed. And I think Shakhtar are sort of inching under the radar here. They were hugely impressive. Not sure how good Basel are or aren't, but they were completely overwhelmed by a team that sort of attacked them like a swarm of bees. They scored 4. They could have scored several more. And Basel's goal was very much a consolation at the death from Ricky van Wolfswinkel, who Norwich fans will remember not particularly fondly, I suspect. But you know, the Shakhtar story is an interesting one. They've been playing away from the Donbass Arena for 6 years now, so they're used to playing in unusual circumstances and often quiet circumstances. They've got a load of Brazilians in their team, exciting Brazilian players, and I would quite fancy them to beat Inter on the evidence of what I saw the other night.
Adam says, is the Europa League becoming less of a laughing stock now and a viable competition to compete in for bigger clubs? Or is it that we've just got to the quarterfinals again and we've found it interesting? That's my supplementary question off the back of his first question.
I would say you have hit the nail on the head there. Certainly, as far as I'm concerned, anyway, I find the group stage is beyond tedious. And the fact they're always played on Thursday nights when you might have just watched football for 5 or 6 days in a row, I generally take Europa League night off and do something else to cleanse the palate.
I'm really enjoying this new knockout format. I think that UEFA need to try and find a way to make their money, but simultaneously keep this current format, because I'm liking it. It's quick, it's sharp. It may work in favour of the bigger teams. That may be the only downside to it.
I think it's the reverse. I think in a one-off game, you've got much more chance than over two legs, I think. They could change the Europa League and do it like this. In fact, do the Champions League, keep that, you make all your billions of pounds. The Europa League, do it like the FA Cup. Just draw out the hat and crack on.
I'd be for that, yeah. Sorry.
A couple of years ago, I think they beefed up the prize money quite considerably, and I do think there are a couple of clubs around Europe who are taking it more seriously than they used to because of it. We got a tweet before the pod of someone pointing out that they were kind of enjoying this festival of football, of having these cups happening now in a sort of compressed time frame rather than interrupting the league season. And I think I think there might be something there. We're always talking about the diminished role of the FA Cup and this sort of thing in the Europa League, or it's really annoying. I've always found that, okay, a season is kind of like a TV show that you're kind of following, and the league games are sort of like the next episode. It's all about narratives and plot lines and characters, and it does feel like when there's a cup weekend, for instance, it feels like suddenly like you're watching The Wire, and suddenly there's an episode where McNulty and Bunk go to Digger World or something instead of sort of investigating the thing they were doing. That's Digger World's fantastic, but I wonder if you sort of, instead of having these cups interrupting the league season, if you just tack them all at the end and we have the sort of, do the cups as an almost separate thing. This is quite utopian. And so, but I think there's something to it. I have really been enjoying having it in this sort of compressed manner now.
Right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll speak to our Football League expert, Ben Fisher. And we'll talk to him about what's happening at Charlton and what's happening at Macclesfield Town. Part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's talk to Ben Fisher, our Football League correspondent. If that's not promoting you, Ben, are you happy with that title?
Yeah, it will do max, I think.
Okay. Right. A lot of people will have seen, like, Save Charlton Athletic trending over social media. It's pretty complicated. They've had a lot of owners in one season, Ben. Can you, in the simplest terms, explain what has happened and what is the state of play right now?
Yeah, it is very complex. Basically, they're very much in limbo. I think, really, maybe it's best to go to the Supporters Trust. In, well, 17-ish days ago, they said 47 days until expulsion, which it's not quite as black and white as that. And now we're about, I don't know, 30 days, less than a month until the start of the season. But they are in a very perilous situation where, basically, if things don't improve significantly, then that is a real threat, that is a possibility. Now, it's not necessarily as bleak as that, but that is looming. And that is, you know, that's in the minds of fans and no doubt those upstairs as well.
Because why?
Well, because the ownership, nobody is passing the test that they need to pass, put simply. So basically now it's up to the club to produce a competent individual to pass the owners and directors test, because they've been taking over, they've had three owners or prospective owners in this season, essentially, because in June they were taken over again, as they were in January. But they're not passing the tests that they need to pass. So they changed hands before actually undergoing the owners and directors test, which is why this problem is flaring up and essentially why they're in the mess they're in.
A lot of people listening will have heard lots of us on this podcast saying, but the anybody can pass the fit and proper person's test or the director's test. Why can't they pass it? And is this the EFL actually being good despite it appearing that they're being bad?
Well, yeah, I think it's easy to point the finger at the EFL, isn't it? And the EFL sort of say, well, we don't regulate who can own companies. We regulate the leagues. So, again, and it's not illegal what they've done. You know, they can transfer the shares of the club without doing the test. That is legal. That is allowed. But it's not ideal, because now you get in this situation where if you then don't pass the test, this is the sort of comeuppance, if you like, in... Yeah, and it's quite bleak.
Is the owners and directors test the same as the fit and proper person's test? I want to get my tests correct.
Yeah, essentially. So it's a bit like FFP, and now it's sustainability and profitability. So, yeah, they're basically the same thing, Max. But the thing here is that, in a way, there's maybe a bit more glimmer of light, sort of, we're talking more on Thursday than there was on sort of Monday, Tuesday, because the three directors have been disqualified or declined, I should say, by the EFL so far. Now, they are minded to appeal that. Paul Elliott is minded to appeal that. But if that doesn't happen, then it's kind of back to the drawing board, and then Charlton must find somebody else and come up with somebody else to go through and sort of jump through those hoops and pass that test.
And Ben, what's the worst-case scenario for Charlton?
Well, I mean... Like I said, they're worried about administration and sort of falling the same way ultimately is Bury. That's certainly the fans' view. When I've spoken to a few people at the club, they're sort of saying, oh, hang on a minute, it's not quite at that stage yet. So I think it's important to stress it's not nowhere near that stage yet. It's just a case of something has to change. And perhaps something I should mention is, again, Roland de Châtelet is still very much a key part in this, because he owns the training ground and the stadium. And anybody who comes in to take on the agreement that is in place kind of has to play ball with de Châtelet here, which, you know, is not the most simple thing. So there's a lot of moving parts. I should stress that we're almost expecting stuff to happen, you know, possibly today, and things might change, hopefully for the better. Even this week, Chris Farnell has been removed as the club solicitor after stepping down as the director. So lots of things are happening. Some sort of, like I said, perhaps could be portrayed as good, but again, it's only very small baby steps.
Explain what's happened to Macclesfield as well. They dropped out of the Football League after a further deduction of 4 points was enforced on appeal, leaving Stevenage reprieved from relegation from League Two. How has that happened?
I have to say, Max, on this one, it's not, well, I suppose a bit like Charlton, this is not just something that's happened overnight. It's been sort of building for months, years, really, in Macclesfield's case. He has stepped down as the chairman, but remains the majority shareholder. You know, he's the only director there. He spends most of his time in Ibiza. And basically, that's been a discord and a relationship of broken promises for a long, long time. You've seen wages paid late, I think, at least six times this season, many times last season as well. And this ultimately has culminated in them being slapped with different punishments. And now they've culminated in this. I have to say that the fans are furious because they feel that the owner should have been punished and not the club. But ultimately, that is what has happened. And just in terms of Stevenage, I have to say they were very surprised in a way at this, because they kind of thought, like, we're getting ready for the National League now. And now they have got this reprieve.
Cheshire Guna says, why has Sheffield Wednesday's penalty been put in place from the start of next season, while Wigan and Macclesfield have had theirs implemented for this one? It seems odd that Wednesday avoid relegation while the other two get that punishment. Are they different crimes?
Yeah, it is the million-dollar question, isn't it? But I think, certainly in terms of Wigan's case, that's an automatic deduction because of the EFL rules. Where it comes to where an independent panel or commission are involved, that's at the discretion of them. So ultimately, it's all a bit vague and hidden, I suppose, in terms of what happens there. But I agree, from a personal point of view, I think it's very unclear and not exactly, doesn't look great.
Now, I know you'd much rather carry on talking about football administration, Ben, than actual football. But since we've got you and you follow, you know, you're our South Coast reporter as well. Are you surprised at Jason Tindall taking over at Bournemouth? How do you see that?
No, not surprised. I think it's quite a sort of ballsy decision, I think, in many ways. Obviously, there's a massive degree of continuity, which is encouraging in lots of ways. But I think it will bring challenges. 12 years is Eddie Howe's sidekick, not to be sniffed at that. And I think, as Jason said the other day, there's really no better apprenticeship to have had. But as we hear all the time, it's very different being sort of number two to number one, the man calling the shot. So big job there as well, because I think there will be departures. As much as Bournemouth insists there won't just be a fire sale of players, inevitably some big players will leave.
Ben, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it as always.
Thanks, Max.
To Fitbar now, Barry. Mark says, has the Scottish Football League missed a trick? Instead of trying to get sponsorship for the football season, they should aim for sponsorship of the close season, or when no games are being played, as it's action-packed. This is now because after Aberdeen, and we discussed what happened on a previous pod about them, a Celtic player accidentally went on a one-day trip to Spain and then came back, didn't tell anyone, and then came on the pitch and played.
Yeah, it's like that scene from Withnail and I, where the two out-of-work drunk actors, one of them announces, we're on holidays by mistake. that famous quote. And Bolly Bolingoli has really, really let himself and his club and the whole Scottish League down. And it's difficult to see how he will actually hold on to his job. I would expect Celtic to sack him. I don't think there's any way back into the side for him. His teammates are furious with him. His manager is livid. The Scottish First Minister had a pop at him after coming out and criticising the Aberdeen players for going on an ill-advised booze up in a city centre pub. She tore into Bolingoli specifically and Scottish football in general again earlier this week, and warned if there was another indiscretion that the game will be shut down. And you have to say, it's probably only a matter of time before someone else does something stupid or gets found to have done something stupid to put the game in jeopardy. And if the game is shut down, it could have horrendous consequences. I mean, if you stretch it as far as you can, theoretically, Rangers went top of the league with a 3-0 win over St. Johnstone in midweek. If Scottish football was shut down and couldn't resume before next summer, Rangers would get handed the title, possibly, thereby ending Celtic's quest for that elusive 10 in a row. And you wouldn't imagine Bolly Bolingoli would be too popular around Celtic Park if that were to happen.
We were speculating as to how he got caught. You know, did he just come back into the training ground with a sombrero on and like an inflatable under his arm or some duty-free cigarettes? Or like, did he go into Neil Lennon's office and say, I bought this wonderful jamon, would you like some? But apparently he was just seen at the airport on the plane because he flew out of Glasgow. You sort of think, if you're surreptitiously going to leave, don't fly out of the airport where they may be supporters of two of the best supported clubs in the whole of the earth. On the Aberdeen one, from my understanding was they went to dinner and were socially distanced. And then they went to a bar next door, and actually quite a lot of them weren't drinking. So I have, even though it's still stupid, I have a lot more sympathy for them if there's a sort of league table of things you shouldn't do when you're told not to go anywhere. There must be moments, i.e. driving to the airport, going through departures, getting on the plane, flying in the plane, landing, all those sort of things that you might think, I'm sure I shouldn't be doing. I'm sure someone told me somewhere not to do this.
Let he who has not accidentally gone on holiday to Spain for a day cast the first stone. Come on.
All right, before we finish, Pierre-Emile Hoybier becomes what, the second best Pierre M in North London. How big a signing is this, Lars? Will this free up Tottenham to become world beaters?
Yeah, I think it's a low-key excellent signing. I mean, there's been a lot of meh on the internet for this, I've seen. But listen, I think this is a team that... I mean, Højbjerg is a very efficient ball winner. He regains possession more than I think most other players in the league. He can pass it around a bit. He seems to have a good head on his shoulders as well. And I think for Spurs, they've been a little bit, after sort of Wanyama went into pretty steep decline, they've not really had any sort of who can just sort of sit and protect the back four. They've ended up playing Moussa Sissoko there, not massively comfortable. He seems a lot more at home when he can bomb forward a bit. Harry Winks has sort of occasionally been used in a sort of English Xavi sort of holding type of role, but I think that maybe he's probably better if you can free him up a little bit to go forward more. I'm not sure defensively that's quite where you want him to be. So just someone who can be solid and win the ball a lot and ping it around a bit, I think is very, very useful for them.
How should I pronounce his surname again? I've been saying Højbjerg. I don't know why. I just
Højbjerg, that's fine.
One more Højbjerg. Time. Højbjerg.
Højbjerg. I don't. The G won't be very pronounced. Højbjerg.
Højbjerg. Okay. Thank you very much.
Danes will hammer me now because the Nordic languages are a little bit different, and Danish is spoken. Written Danish is almost completely similar to Norwegian. Spoken Danish is quite different. But Pierre-Emile Højbjerg.
Thank you.
I think
much.
Will be good.
WBA Rangers Stan says, on average, what row in the stands is hit the most by wayward shots? Obviously, we hear a lot about row Z, but it could be argued percentage-wise, it's unlikely to be hit the most. Barry, what row do you think most commonly gets hit?
Row N.
Okay, Jordan?
I'm going to go row F.
Okay. Lars?
Row A, for all the ones around the ground, see?
Okay.
See? I think this is where the analytics guys have got to earn their corn. Got to go through all the... there's got to be an Opta guy out there who will just go through all of and see where all the wayward shots landed and produce a map.
It's XR, isn't it? XR is what we're looking for, expected row. Finally, thanks to everyone who said nice things about the pod we did yesterday. Rob says we need a Philippe Auclair pod special where he can say anything he likes. The Guardian puts up disclaimers every 17 seconds that he is in no way speaking on their behalf. And then lawsuits galore. This is what GoFundMe was created for, he says. We'll send our love to Philippe. Yes, Lars?
I mean, there was once Philippe was on here and said something that was completely unpublishable, and I wonder if we should have just run with it, but just bleeped the relevant names. That would have been tremendous content. People can speculate endlessly.
Right, thank you so much, everybody, today. I had a nice time. Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Jordan.
Cheers, pal.
Thank you, Barry.
Cheers, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.